So other, so we've shifted now from ambiance to marketplace. Okay, so I guess I won't carry that. All right, so over here at the marketplace, all right, so I've got a few copies of some of my books over here. 10-Minute Transformation, it's about spiritual disciplines that take 10 minutes or less. Growing with God are some spiritual practices. And Newsworthy is about how to be good news in your community. And so I just have a few copies of those. The books are 16, the booklets are 5. So if you get nothing else out of the class, you might get a book. Okay. All right. I'm working on a book on Esther. So you are the very first people to get some of this material out of the book of Esther. If I can find a publisher, it'll be published. So far, no publisher yet, but we're working on it. Thank you so much for coming this morning. And I hope that this material is a blessing for you and that you'll benefit from it. Let's pray together. Father, thank you for another day. As we gather together this morning, help our hearts and our minds to be open and receptive to a word from you. We believe that in every keynote, in every class, in every conversation that we're engaged in today, that you're present and that you have something for us. Help us to receive it, Father. We pray in Jesus' name. Amen. Amen.
Hey!
Okay, now that...
Sorry. Is there ambiance?
Sorry, Chris.
Yes. Oh, no. No problem.
Sorry.
All right, so you may be aware that the name of God does not appear anywhere in the book of Esther. So this book in the book about God is conspicuously silent about God, the name above every name does not appear in the book of Esther. But we're actually not going to talk about that. I'm just going to acknowledge that. What I do want to talk about are 10 names that appear near the end of the book of Esther, and they stand kind of like a weathered headstone at the end of the book of Esther. They're a mixture here of Persian and Hebrew, and so I'm not even going to bother about entertaining you with pronunciations because I would butcher these names. These names are listed in the book of Esther, chapter 9, as the only named individuals who died in this massive battle that took place in Susa, the citadel of Persia. 500 people died in this battle. These are the only 10 names that were given of the individuals who died in that battle. So they must be pretty important names. In fact, in the text, the Hebrew text of the book of Esther, these names are actually drawn out of the text and actually listed one under the other. And so if we were reading the Hebrew text of Esther, our eyes would be kind of forced to stop and to linger over each of these names as if the author of Esther wanted us to stop and to pay attention. It almost makes us think about these records of the names of the fallen in places like the Vietnam Veterans Memorial Wall or the 9/11 Memorial. You have this record of the names of the fallen. And one after the other, these names just reminding us these are real people who had names and faces. They had faces that mothers had had memorized. They came from places with memories and hopes and dreams, and we wonder if they meant something to someone. But as we dig around in the storyline of Esther, we find out that these 10, the only 10 people named in this massive battle in Susa, which this battle in Susa took place when the Jews, empowered by Esther, were allowed to defend themselves against this great Persian onslaught. But these 10 individuals meant nothing to the most important person in their life. And we're going to circle back around to that and talk about why that was. Because, in part, God meant nothing to the most important someone in their life. So let's talk about the back part of that statement. Some scholars, when they talk to us about the book of Esther, talk about it as a time of disenchantment. So you have seasons of enchantment and seasons of disenchantment. And some scholars describe Esther as a time of disenchantment. Times of disenchantment are when God is at least seems to be inattentive and inactive in our lives. So in the Old Testament, right, you move from the Red Sea being parted, you move from the walls of Jericho falling down, miracles happening, to a book where the name of God doesn't even appear. A time of disenchantment. It seems like God is inactive and inattentive. Which would be times of suffering in our own lives. Cancer hits, relationships fall apart. Those would be seasons of disenchantment, seasons when it seems like God is inattentive and inactive in our lives. Some scholars would say that our entire Western culture right now is in a season of disenchantment. 1,500 years ago, that it was a lot easier, that most people found it much easier to say, oh yeah, God is very active in our world today. God is very attentive to the daily life of people in our world today. Most would say that 1,500 years ago, the Western world was more enchanted. There was a belief in fairies and trolls and angels, that life was more enchanted. But now we live in a disenchanted time. There are more people who don't believe that God is attentive and active in our world today. And that's the world of Esther. That's the world that Esther takes place in. And that's the world that this figure named Haman lives in. Haman, in the story of Esther, is the figure who stands for all people who do not believe in a God who's active and attentive in the world around them. And in part because of this, Haman is the one who devalues the lives of virtually everyone else around him except for his own life. And so in the book of Esther, we come upon what I call here Haman's principle. The less involved we believe God to be in human life, the more justified we can be in devaluing human life. Because what we learn here in Esther is that these 10 names, these 10 individuals who died in this great battle in Susa, are actually Haman's sons. And what we learn is that they've died because of Haman's conceit and Haman's self-centeredness and Haman's devaluing of all human life except for his own. Because Haman has absolutely no room in his worldview for a God who's active and attentive in the world around him. So these 10 names are recorded at the end of Esther, not because they're just casualties of this conflict in Susa, but because they're casualties of conceit. Haman essentially acts in a way that places himself in the center of the story of Esther, where he demands to be worshipped and adored by everyone in the kingdom of Persia. And he decenters any notion of God in the story of Esther. And as he does this, as he decenters God in the story of Esther, he also ends up devaluing everybody around him, including the lives of his sons. So here, listen to this text here. This is Esther 5, beginning in verse 9. Haman went out that day, joyful and glad of heart. But when Haman saw Mordecai in the king's gate, that he neither rose nor trembled before him, he was filled with wrath against Mordecai. Nevertheless, Haman restrained himself and went home, and he sent and brought his friends and his wife Zeresh. And Haman recounted to them the splendor of his riches, the number of his sons, all the promotions with which the king had honored him, and how he had advanced him above the officials and the servants of the king. Then Haman said, "Even Queen Esther, let no one but me come with the king to the feast she prepared. And tomorrow also I am invited by her together with the king. Yet all this is worth nothing to me, so long as I see Mordecai, the Jew, sitting at the king's gate." And his wife Zeresh and all his friends said to him, "Let a gallows 50 cubits high be made, and in the morning tell the king to have Mordecai hanged upon it, and go joyfully with the king to the feast." This idea pleased Haman, and had the gallows made. So notice here, and I realize we're kind of jumping right in the middle of the story of Esther. I'm going to sort of assume you've got some knowledge of the story of Esther that you can go back and catch yourself up with it. But Haman gathers his wife, he gathers his wise friends here, and in their presence he recounts. The word recounts is used here. It's sort of an accounting term. It means to count up things. It means to actually make a list of things. And what Haman does in the presence of his wife and the presence of these wise friends who literally are counselors, so he gathers his counselors around him and gathers his wife around him, and he recounts things because he's upset. And he recounts two lists here. So on list one is the splendor of his riches, all the promotions with which the king had honored him, how he had advanced him above the officials and the servants of the king. This statement, "Well, even Queen Esther, let no one but me come with the king to the feast she prepared. And tomorrow also I'm invited by her together with the king." And within that list, the number of his sons. So all of that's on list number one, that he is recounting in the presence of his wise friends and his wife. Which is a pretty good list here, which essentially means his wallet is fat. I mean, he is well off. He's rich. He's wealthy. He's been promoted fast and far by the king. He's advanced in his career as high as he can go. He's been noticed by the queen, which is awesome. And the number of his sons. He's got 10 sons. Which, some of us would be horrified, right? But in the ancient world, to have multiple sons was a huge deal. And we know this was especially true in Persia. To have multiple sons was a sign of great power and great respect. And so all of this is added up on this list. The number of his sons. So these are living, breathing people. All 10 of these names that we have seen on that list. The number of his sons. He adds up that list. And, you know, if you are making up a list today of, here are all the things that are great about my life, here's what's wonderful about my life, you know, your list might look a little different than that. But if you had children, your children would probably be on that list. The number of his sons. And then he has list number two. And there's only one thing on list number two. And that is Mordecai, the Jew, sitting at the king's gate. So we haven't had time to read the rest of the story, but we know that Haman has demanded the near worship of everyone within the kingdom of Persia, including these minorities, including these misfits, including these people that he would consider to be just monsters, these people that are worthless, which we'll see here in a moment. And everyone has made his wish his command. They bowed before him, except for one. There's only one person in the entire kingdom of Persia who refuses to bow before him, this minority, Mordecai. He's got all of this, and he only has this one thing that he doesn't have. But notice what he says in verse 13. Yet all of this is worth nothing. And we're going to look at this word nothing to me, so long as I see Mordecai the Jew sitting at the king's gate. Everything on list number one is worth nothing, so long as I see this one thing on list number two. And you know, forget for a moment all of these things. The promotions, the career advancement, the wealth, the number of his sons. What Haman is saying there is even his 10 sons, even these 10 boys who call him dad, are worth nothing. Because he can't get the near worship of this one minority. Now, this word nothing is important in Esther because it shows up earlier when he's talking to the king about the rest of the Jews. And it's translated prophet there. Esther 3, verse 8. Haman said to the king, "There is a certain people scattered abroad, dispersed among the peoples in all the provinces of your kingdom. Their laws are different from those of every other people. They do not keep the king's laws." Lies. Lies. "So that it is not to the king's profit to tolerate them." Same word. All this is worth nothing. It is not to the king's profit to tolerate them. See, in Haman's world view, Haman looks at other people through this certain lens, and they only have worth if they have profit, if they can contribute to the one goal that he deems worthwhile. And the only goal that he deems worthwhile is his own supremacy over every ethnicity and every socioeconomic class and every misfit and marginalized people group in the entire Persian kingdom. And if they don't, they're worthless. And so even his own sons become worthless. I mean, we would anticipate that a white supremacist would adore his own children. We would anticipate that a radical terrorist would adore his own children. But Haman views his own 10 sons as worthless because he only views human worth through that one lens. People only have worth if they can contribute meaningfully to a preconceived goal, if they can produce something worthwhile. And if they can't, they're worthless, they're profitless, they're worth nothing. And so this is Haman's principle. The less involved we believe God to be in human life, the more justified we can be in devaluing that human life. Now, thankfully, there is a mirror image to Haman, an opposite image to Haman in the book of Esther. And that is Mordecai. Someone who stands as his opposite. What we see here in the book of Esther is what ethicists and philosophers call instrumental worth versus intrinsic or ingrained worth. So instrumental worth says people only have value if they can lead to or produce something else valuable. That alone, people have very little value or worth in and of themselves. You're only valuable to me if you can produce something that I deem valuable. Intrinsic or ingrained worth says you have value simply because you exist, simply because you are, simply because you're a created being in and of itself. You have value. Regardless of what you produce or contribute, you have value. And what we see in Esther through Haman is this view of humanity. Kenneth Feinberg was the, let me get this right, special master for the federal September 11th Victim Compensation Fund. So he was asked to create and then administer the federal funds that were given to the families of the victims of September 11th. When he was asked to do that, he was also asked to follow the letter of the law, which said that all of those families of the victims had to receive funds that would be measured according to the financial worth of the victims. And what that meant was that the families of the bankers, the families of the stock traders, and so forth, would receive more than the families of the firemen, the families of the policemen, and the families of the secretaries who died. And Feinberg really struggled with that, as he later wrote about this. He struggled with that because people would come up to him and say, "My husband died a hero as a firefighter in September 11th. Why are we receiving so much less than the banker who worked for Enron?" And he had a difficult time explaining that to the families. But he was constrained by the letter of the law there. Later on, in the wake of the Virginia Tech shootings and the death of 32 victims, Feinberg was once again brought in to create and distribute a compensation system. But this time it was privately funded, and so he didn't have to stick to the letter of the law here. And so this time the victims, faculty, and student families all received the same amount of compensation. And so later, reflecting on that whole thing, he wrote this. He said, "In the case of September 11th, if there's a next time and Congress again decides to award public compensation, I hope the law will declare that all life should be treated the same. I believe public compensation should avoid financial distinctions, which only fuel the hurt and grief of the survivors. I believe all lives should be treated the same." So what he is writing about there is ingrained worth, intrinsic worth, which is the opposite of how Haman viewed the people around him. Your life only has worth if it contributes to the goal that I deem worthwhile. So believing that people's value is instrumental based on what they can create rather than ingrained, based on who they are as created beings, is easier to do when you believe that there's no creator involved in their lives. And that's the kind of world that Haman lived in. And it's really the kind of world that we live in. I think racism, ageism, sexism, that we see going on in our world today is ultimately rooted in that sense that if God's not active and attentive in our world today, then I can treat others the way that I want to. Let me skip ahead here. So Mordecai is the opposite figure in the book of Esther. Mordecai is the first person in the entire narrative of Esther to acknowledge that there's actually a God who is active, who is attentive, who's kind of a director behind the play that's happening here in the book of Esther. And so he's the one who comes in Esther 5 and verse 14, who comes to Esther and says, "Well, who knows whether you've not come to the kingdom for such a time as this. He's the first person in the narrative to pull the curtain back, especially for Esther, and to say, I think there's a lot more going on here than it might appear. Perhaps, and we have to read behind and between the lines here, but clearly he's saying, perhaps there's a God at work here. And he's introducing the idea of providence here. Perhaps there's a God at work who's active and attentive in our lives. And because of that, it's no coincidence then that Mordecai is also the person in the narrative who demonstrates a high value and a very different value of human life than Haman. So notice this text here in Esther chapter 2, beginning in verse 5. Now there was a Jew, so this is how we're introduced to him. There was a Jew in Susa, the citadel, whose name was Mordecai, the son of Jair, son of Shimei, son of Kish, a Benjaminite, who had been carried away from Jerusalem among the captives, carried away with Jeconiah, king of Judah, who was Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, and carried away. He was bringing up Hadassah, that is Esther, the daughter of his uncle, for she had neither father nor mother. The young woman had a beautiful figure and was lovely to look at. And when her father and mother had died, Mordecai took her as his own daughter. So, I mean, what a striking contrast. We have Haman, who has 10 sons. And what does Haman say about his 10 sons? Worth nothing. Why? They can't contribute to his goal. And we have Mordecai, and he takes Esther, who is not his daughter, but he treats her as his daughter. Why? Not because she is contributing something to him, not because she's done something valuable for him, not because she's diligent or dynamic or dazzling. That's not what the text is telling us. It's simply because she is. Mordecai is the opposite of Haman in the story here. Mordecai is the person in the text who treats people with value simply because they are, because of their ingrained, their intrinsic worth. And so she who is not Mordecai's daughter is deemed invaluable, taken in, treated as his daughter, and they who are Haman's sons are dismissed as inconsequential, mere opposites of one another. And so, in contrast to Haman's principle, we have Mordecai's principle. The more involved we believe God to be in human life, the more compelled we are to value that same life. And so what we see playing out here then in Esther are these two radically different ways of looking at human life. And I think a call to be a community who chooses to view life in a certain way. And a glimpse, just a glimpse, but a glimpse of the way that God looks at human life. And a glimpse at the community that Jesus was forming in his own ministry. So we begin to hear things a little bit differently. When we realize that our seemingly disenchanted world is truly enchanted, that our story of God not at work is in fact a story of God hard at work, we're compelled to treasure and cherish all his works, especially his most wondrous work, humanity, all humanity, the marginal, the minorities, the monsters. So notice this long text, very familiar text, but listen to it now in light of what we covered there in Esther. And he said, there was a man who had two sons. The younger of them said to his father, Father, give me the share of property that is coming to me. And he divided his property between them. Not many days later, the younger son gathered all he had, took a journey into a far country, and there squandered his property in reckless living. And when he had spent everything, a severe famine arose in that country, and he began to be in need. So he went and hired himself out to one of the citizens of that country, who sent him into his fields to feed pigs. And he was longing to be fed with the pods that the pigs ate, and no one gave him anything. But when he came to himself, he said, "How many of my father's hired servants have more than enough bread? But I perish here with hunger. I will arise and go to my father, and I'll say to him, 'Father, I've sinned against heaven and before you. I'm no longer worthy to be called your son. Treat me as one of your hired servants.' And he arose and came to his father, but while he was still a long way off, his father saw him and felt compassion and ran and embraced him and kissed him. And the son said, 'Father, I've sinned against heaven before you. I'm no longer worthy to be called your son.' But the father said to his servants, 'Bring quickly the best robe and put it on him, put a ring on his hand, shoes on his feet. Bring fat calf and kill it. Let us eat and celebrate. For this my son was dead and is alive again. He was lost and is found.' And they began to celebrate. Now his older son was in the field, and he came and drew near to the house and heard music and dancing. He called one of the servants and asked what these things meant. And he said to him, 'Your brother has come. Your father has killed the fattened calf because he received him back safe and sound.' But he was angry. He refused to go in. His father came out and entreated him. And he answered his father, 'Look, these many years I've served you, never disobeyed your command. You never gave me a young goat that I might celebrate with my friends. But when this son of yours came, who devoured your property with prostitutes, you killed the fattened calf for him.' And he said to him, 'Son, you're always with me, and all that is mine is yours. It was fitting to celebrate and be glad. For this your brother was dead and is alive. He was lost and is found.'" And notice that line, "I'm no longer worthy to be called your son." Because in this parable, Jesus understands that we humans often view ourselves and the older brother standing for us. We often view other people through the lens of instrumental value. People only have worth if they can contribute meaningfully. "I am no longer worthy to be called your son." Why does he say that? Well, it's because he's brought debt to the family. He's devoured the family's property. And he's brought disgrace and dishonor to the family. He's been subtracting from the family, not adding to the family's bottom line. That's what that statement means. And that's what the older brother means too. This individual's worth has declined. It's plummeted through the arc of this story from an instrumental perspective. But why then does the father do what he does? Well, because he doesn't view the son through that lens. He views the son through the lens of ingrained worth, intrinsic worth. He's worthwhile, worthy, simply because he is. And so the shock of the story is that when the son's profit, the father is the lowest, the father's passion is at the highest. And that's what the older brother can't stand, right? How could the father do this when the son's profit is at the lowest? How could the father demonstrate such high passion? And of course, that's Jesus' point here with the parable, that when our own profit, from an instrumental perspective, is the lowest, the father's passion for us is the highest. That he loves us simply because we are. And the call of the parable is for us to be the community that loves other people simply because they are. Because right before this, right, Jesus is being criticized because he's eating with people whose worth is considered too low even to eat with, from an instrumental perspective. And so what we see playing out here is what is glimpsed in the book of Esther. Haman and Mordecai, two very different ways of looking at the worth of humanity. Paul Kalanithi in 2013 was a 36-year-old neurosurgeon, rising through the ranks of Stanford Medical Center, one of the best neurosurgeons in the country. He had already kind of mapped out his career. He had degrees in literature and neuroscience. His driving goal in life was to answer the question, what gives meaning to human life? And so he believed that literature and neuroscience answered that question. So he was going to make a career of neurosurgery, and then teaching, and then writing, those three blocks. And then in 2013, at just 36 years old, healthy, outdoor, never smoked, came down with lung cancer. And suddenly had months or years left to live. They weren't quite sure how long. It turned out to be months. And so now all of that planning and those goals were gone. At first he tried to keep on operating, but he didn't even have the strength, the stamina to do neurosurgery anymore. So he decided to write this book, When Breath Becomes Air. And it would become his chronicle of how a person finds meaning as they die. The most poignant moment in the book is Paul is lying on a cot, he's dying of cancer, in a hospital room next to his wife, who's giving birth to their daughter, Katie. And 8 months later, he dies. And so he's dying for 8 months while Katie is living for her first 8 months. And the last chapter of the book is his letter to his daughter, Katie. And so he writes a remarkable letter to her about her intrinsic worth. He says this, "I hope I'll live long enough that she has some memory of me. Words have a longevity, I do not. I had thought I could leave her a series of letters, but what would they say? I don't know what this girl will be like when she's 15. I don't even know if she'll take to the nickname we've given her. There is perhaps only one thing to say to this infant, who is all future, overlapping briefly with me, whose life, barring the improbable, is all but past. And that message is simple. When you come to one of the many moments in life where you must give an account of yourself, provide a ledger of what you've been and done and meant to the world, do not, I pray, discount that you filled a dying man's days with a sated joy. A joy unknown to me in all my prior years. A joy that does not hunger for more and more, but rests satisfied in this time right now. That is an enormous thing." And you see what he's doing there is he's trying to help his daughter understand that no matter what else happens in the rest of her life, that she has value and worth simply because she is, simply because she exists. And her father, found the greatest joy that he had ever known. That he had ever known. Before she could contribute anything. She's 8 months old. What can she do? Very little. And yet, she had brought him the greatest joy that she had ever known simply by existing. That's the kind of worth that we see exhibited by Mordecai, that we do not see exhibited by Haman in the book of Esther. That's the kind of community that Esther ultimately calls us to be, that Jesus explicitly calls us to be, of the kind of community that would value people simply because they are. Not at all because of what they might produce or contribute, but simply because they are. The book of Esther points us to a God whose love for people is not based on instrumental worth, not contingent upon their capacity to contribute, or based on their benefit to some segment of society, but a love formed and founded on intrinsic and ingrained worth. A love tender and fierce from day one, when all we can do is sleep and cry and eat. A love deep and wide until the end, when all we can do is sleep and cry and eat. Simply because we are. A love that beats like a drum, even when we stagger home, shamefaced, brokenhearted, from a season of selfish mutiny. Because underneath our indiscretion, we still bear His image. Behind the flaws, we still carry His fingerprints. It's a love that burns simply because we are. And see, it's that kind of love that Jesus Himself experienced. His baptism, Matthew chapter 3, when Jesus was baptized, immediately He went up from the water, and behold, the heavens were opened to Him. He saw the Spirit of God descending like a dove, coming to rest on Him. And behold, a voice from heaven said, "This is My beloved Son, with whom I am well pleased." Then Jesus was led up by the Spirit into the wilderness to be tempted by the devil. Some of these slides you don't have, if you're looking for it. So this is strategically placed. These words are strategically spoken before Jesus has an opportunity to prove His worth in His public ministry. Before Jesus does anything, these words of affirmation come. "You are My beloved Son." Why? Simply because you are. This is how God views humanity, regardless of race or class or education or social or sexual orientation. This is how God views humanity. Simply because you are. You are My beloved. Intrinsic worth, ingrained worth. Henry Nouwen, reflecting on this passage, would say this: "Who am I? I'm the beloved." That's the voice Jesus heard when He came out of the Jordan River. Jesus listened to that voice all the time. He was able to walk right through life. He clung to that voice. There are many other voices speaking loudly. Prove that you're the beloved. Prove you're worth something. Prove you have any contribution to make. These voices are so strong in this world. These were the voices Jesus heard right after He heard, "You are My beloved." And Jesus said, "No, I don't have to prove anything. I'm already the beloved." If you keep that in mind, you can deal with an enormous amount of success as well as an enormous amount of failure without losing your identity. Because your identity is that you are the beloved. Long before your father and mother, your brothers and sisters, your teachers, your church, or any people touched you in a loving as well as a wounding way, long before you were rejected by some person or praised by somebody else, that voice has been there. Always. And we've been called to be the community that speaks that voice to everybody. The one community on earth that speaks that voice to everybody, no matter who they are. You are the beloved. You are the beloved. Richard Beck has a book called Unclean, writes a fantastic blog. In his book Unclean, and on his blog, he writes about people that are called monsters. And what he means by that are the misfits, the social outcasts, the people that are often rejected by society and by churches, people that are bullied and often written against. And he notes that one pop singer, Lady Gaga, at least early in her career, had a group of followers called Little Monsters. And they really were the rejects, the social outcasts. And they found in this pop star kind of a safe place, a community, a sense of belonging around her. And so he writes, "Religious institutions in Jesus' time and in our own continue to scapegoat outsiders, but the little monsters should feel affection from the church." You know, what if we really became the community that said, even to little monsters, you are the beloved. You are the beloved. Because that's what starts all the way back in the book of Esther. It calls us to be the community that believes in God is present and active in the world to benefit all humanity. And so we too benefit all humanity. Not for what they can contribute, not for how we may benefit, but simply because people are. Well, that's our time. We'll close with that. Thank you so much for being here today.